On episode 462 of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Dr. Rob Barrett and Dr. Lou Frascutti and discuss their book, Hardwired, How Our Instincts to Be Healthy Are Making Us Sick. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/462.
Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go.
Raz, how are you doing?
Good, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. We are doing the traveling around the country, and we're just dodging left and right to try to avoid this COVID thing. People around us are starting to get tested positive. And so far, our testing has been negative. And I have a thermometer that I now carry around with me, and we check our temperatures. And so trying to do the right responsible thing, wearing masks in public and doing those things. And so you can have your position about all of that, but the reality of it is, do you really want to take your chances and get it? And
right.
If I got it, I would say, okay, I got it. And I'd hunker down somewhere for 2 weeks, and then I'd say, okay, I'm probably going to be fine from here on out. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of people don't have that. And if you're around someone who's ill, you really have to think about what your behavior is potentially doing to them.
Yes.
So my daughter is staying with her mother this week, because it's closer to her workplace, and her mother got tested at a positive. So, not that either of them done anything wrong. It's just they got exposed in some way or another, and now they have to deal with that. And now I have to somewhat deal with that and go get tested again, just because of the exposure. So just kind of, be aware that that stuff's out there, and it's going to get probably a lot worse before it gets better. And even though there's news of a vaccine coming out and the testing and things that'll have to go on with that, that's a ways off for all of us. It can seem kind of pretty exciting when they make an announcement like that, like, hey, we've got this thing. They don't have this thing. They have this potential of a thing that they have to start building and manufacturing and apparently keeping below a certain temperature, below freezing, which most freezers don't do today. So there's a lot of logistics, a lot of things will have to go on before we can actually say we're out of the woods on this. So just be safe. And that's what I'm trying to do as we travel through the United States is, make sure that I'm staying safe, get myself tested when I can. If I get exposed, I'll go get tested again. That's going to be our life going forward for a little while.
Yeah, I suspect that's the case for a lot of people. Mike deals with this for work. COVID is an important part of his health and safety responsibilities for his work. But we do see time and time again how mask wearing and hand washing has been, really helpful with keeping the count down. And I know the whole world is actually going through a whole new wave of it. And this winter is going to be really hard, especially in places like where we live in Michigan, where it's going to be cold and we're going to spend a lot of time inside. But, again, if you just take a few of those extra steps and wear your mask and wash your hands, it really can do a lot to protect you. And like we've also talked about, Alan, you and I, being healthy, just taking the extra step and taking care of your physical health will also be a huge part of the process of keeping you healthy in the long run.
Absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the interview then. Our guests today are a PhD from the world of social science and an MD from the world of medicine. They combine forces to bring this emerging human crisis to light. They share fascinating facts and little-told stories to weave together real-life cases that describe how our ancient evolutionary drives are propelling us toward ill health and disease. With no further ado, here is Dr. Rob Barrett and Dr. Lou Frascutti. Dr. Rob, Dr. Lou, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Thanks for having us.
So the book is called Hardwired, How Our Instincts to Be Healthy Are Making Us Sick. And, you know, one of the things I have to say about this book is it's very unusual that I'll read a book and learn more than one or two things, because I've had so many guests on in health and fitness. And honestly, most books are just repeating something I've read somewhere else. And occasionally someone will pop in with some new idea, some new thing I've never heard. But I got to the first chapter and I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that was that bad. And get to the next chapter and like, that's very interesting. I've never heard about those people before. And then the next one, oh, so that's what was going on with me. It was just like every chapter, I'm like just kind of a new thing in my head. And so really, really great book.
Yeah, thanks very much. You know, part of that was by design. We when Dr. Liu and I sat down and realized that we're both asking the same question, why do we do the things that we do? But from different standpoints, Dr. Liu being an ER physician, so he sees that in the medical world, and me seeing that mostly in the social science world. When we started to look at the intersection of those two, we started to discover all of these amazing facts, as you say, and stories that can be told about how these things play upon each other and affect us in our everyday life. So I'm glad you found that. We were actually, you know, as our journey was over many years writing this book, our journey was the same. We were shocked at how much our social world is now directing our health, our biological health as well. And that was one of the true takeaways of the book.
You know what the aha moment for Rob and I when we were doing a previous interview was that humans, as well designed as they are running on outdated software. So the software we're running on served us well, you know, for the previous million years. But the fast-paced environment of today's world leaves our brain confused as to what to do. And, you know, Rob explains quite nicely that we have too much choice in food, too much choice in, you know, social media, too much choice in everything. And with that choice comes the consequences of bad decisions that are driven by something that's hardwired into us. I mean, dopamine drives humans. You get rewarded for water, you get rewarded for food, finding water, finding food, and having sex. And having sex is the greatest dopamine release in your brain. And that's because, you know, humans want to be around for a long time. But if you have access to too much food 24 hours a day, you know, 365 days a year, we have to sort of ask ourselves, why is this obesity epidemic all over the world? It's not just in North America, it's all over the world. And we really believe that we're not wired properly. And so what we need to do is patch our software to make sure we can live in these modern times.
Yeah, you know, one of the first things you got into in the book was, quite frankly, was terrifying. I worked in the oil and gas business, and so we were, you know, it was safety. And, you know, anything that went wrong, like you took a step wrong, you know, walking up the steps, you were supposed to write up a paper of a near miss. And, you know, so safety was just drilled into us. In fact, it was actually a part of our bonus. If we had safety events above a certain threshold, we didn't get that portion of our bonus. Which made sometimes me question a lot of the reporting. And as an auditor, that's, you know, part of what I was like, okay, are we doing this right? What astounded me was that the same problems we were seeing in the oil field with health and safety are happening in our hospitals. And I think the stat that kind of blew me away was 440,000 deaths per year due to a mistake.
You know, there was a study that came out of Hopkins that basically said hospital-related injuries were the third leading cause. And it's not as if, as a healthcare provider, I go to work wanting to hurt someone. But it's like you said, oil and gas are so far ahead in taking safety seriously that the healthcare industry, unfortunately, still doesn't believe this is a major problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. We put in some really interesting numbers around preventable error in hospitals, and one of the little math stats that we put in there that was really fascinating for Dr. Liu and I as well is, if you look at comparing hospitals, a modern hospital, to say the Iraq surge in 2007. So remember, the Iraq surge was 160,000 troops that went to Iraq, and they experienced a death rate of 904. Servicemen and women. In that same year, 35.1 million people visited a modern U.S. hospital. And if you use that number of roughly 400,000 preventable errors and deaths, then really it was more dangerous to visit a modern U.S. hospital in that same year than it was to serve in Iraq during the deadliest year in Iraq. That is just astounding. And now one in four people that visit a modern hospital are at risk of experiencing a preventable error in hospitals.
Now, part of the solution of this is obvious. Don't go to the hospital, but you need to go to the hospital if you have an acute issue, if you're having a heart attack or a stroke or something like that. You absolutely need to quickly get to a hospital. What else can we do to help prevent us from being a part of that statistic?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we look at is, okay, why are these happening? What's the nature of these errors that are happening? And it's really not a lack of understanding of medicine anymore. Of course, there's always room for improvement there. The technological advances is really not that we don't have these available. Sure, there are some, you know, cognitive biases that play into diagnostic error and what have you, but really these are non-technical errors. And what we've learned a lot, and we use the comparison in the book as well, is aviation safety. Aviation, same thing. They looked at, you know, these aircraft that are so sophisticated now that really the types of errors that we're seeing are of a non-technical nature. And that's the area, that's the main domain that we need to improve upon. But as the book, suggests, our hardwired parts of ourselves mean that we're very social creatures. And that means that we have to, you know, dance and play around in groups, even in very serious settings like the hospital as well. And some of that group dynamic and that interplay, that psychology of being part of the group, some of the hierarchies that are built into the hospital system mean that it's sometimes difficult for us to communicate effectively. So there's leadership issues, there's communication issues. And Dr. Liu sees that a lot more than I do, obviously, on a day-to-day basis in the hospital environment.
Alan, there's in the emergency department, there's, you know, 33 documented biases that emergency physicians have that lead to error. And that leads us into a similar situation in industry, a condition known as procedural intentional noncompliance, so that people do bad things knowing they're doing bad things. And so you have to try and figure out, well, why would somebody take a shortcut when they know they shouldn't be taking a shortcut? Well, if it's the end of an 8-hour shift and they're exhausted and they just want to get out of there, they'll come up with a diagnosis and confirm in their mind that that's the right diagnosis. When if that patient had been seen at the beginning of the shift, maybe that wouldn't have happened. You know, there was really good study done out of the UK where they had staff wear red badges and green badges, and the red badges were people that were fatigued and the green badges were people that were fresh. And the patients had a choice of who they wanted to take care of them. And they always chose the person that had, you know, the more sleep and that was relaxed. So when you said, what can people do? First thing is make sure a healthcare provider washes their hand right in front of you before they touch you. And if they refuse to, then don't allow them to touch you. Raise a stink. And the other thing is ask them how long they've been up. And if they've been up, you know, for a 36-hour shift and they're proud of it, ask for another healthcare provider. Two simple things. And bring an advocate for yourself as well. You know, you need someone that's going to help you advocate through the system. And unfortunately, if seniors go into healthcare facilities, which they're more prone to, most of the time they're still, you know, a little maybe too respectful of the healthcare profession and don't question what's going on. Well, we know that Institute of Medicine study done in the States showed that 35% of all healthcare dollars spent in the US are totally wasted. So there's more than enough money in the system to develop a better system. But like you said earlier, and the ideal thing I always say is we should try and get rid of the patient so you don't have to use healthcare in the first place.
Yeah. So avoid the hospital when it's appropriate by staying healthy. A lot of things we're going to talk about here is if you keep yourself healthy, you're in the hospital less. And if you're in the hospital less, then you don't have to worry about it as much. But then when you are, advocate for yourself, ask those questions. I was just shocked that there was not a check balance or something to say that they had to wash their hands between seeing patients. I just, I don't know, you assume some of these things are just going to happen, because if anyone knows what they're doing, it's the guy that's walking in there with the white coat. But we need to ask more questions. We need to be on the medical team with the doctor. This episode of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is sponsored by Free Lunch Coffee. If you've listened to the podcast for long, you know I enjoy starting my mornings with a good cup of coffee, or two, or three. You've also probably noticed that I love having sponsors that go above and beyond just making good products. Let me introduce you to Free Lunch Coffee. Free Lunch Coffee gives away 50% of the money they make to end hunger in the lives of young children. Each bag of their coffee provides 10 meals to children in need. Beyond this fantastic cause, Free Lunch Coffee has great coffee that is specialty grade, certified organic, and fair trade. And they offer a 100% money-back guarantee for 30 days, so you have nothing to lose. Check it out at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/freelunch with no space. As a 40 Plus Fitness Podcast listener, Free Lunch Coffee is offering a 10% discount to you. Use coupon code 40PLUS at checkout. Here's that address again, 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/freelunch. And the coupon code is 40PLUS for 10% off. Free Lunch Coffee lets you drink your coffee with compassion. I don't think anyone right now doesn't know that willpower is a finite resource. And if we get fatigued, sometimes willpower just gets weaker. That's why it's easier to eat ice cream after dinner than it is that you would not necessarily eat it for breakfast, because you know better. But you talk about actually taking some of these tactical indulgences. And I was talking to a client today, and he said he just loves candy corn. And he's lost 150 pounds. And he's like, but I love candy corn. So this time of year, when it rolls around, I'm going to buy myself a small bag of candy corn. And he says that keeps him on track for a whole quarter. And he says, then he knows around Thanksgiving and Christmas, he'll give himself another little treat. Can you just talk about why tactical indulgences are a great way to bolster our willpower, or at least help us through those times?
Yeah, for sure. Well, if we start with the idea that, you know, we do have this hardwiring. So if we're stuck with this hardwiring for now, that means we have this reward system in our brain that's constantly turned on. It's constantly wanting reward all the time. So we can either try to fight it, or we can try to work with it somehow. And if you're trying to fight it, you end up, you know, this idea of building resilience all the time doesn't necessarily work. It becomes more and more difficult. So the idea of these tactical indulgences means that you are allowing yourself to feed the reward center of your brain, but in more, perhaps in more positive, ideally in more positive ways as well, taking little breaks. So willpower is almost like the gas in your car. You can run out of it. You can burn through it and run out of it. You have to keep adding it. You have to keep replenishing it as well. So there was a great experiment that illustrates this, and it was the cookie and radish experiment. And what they did was they had people have either some cookies or some radishes in a control group. And then they had them do some math problems afterwards, some really challenging math problems. And they found that the ones that had the cookies did a lot better, and they were able to last a lot longer with the math test. And that's because they were able to free up some of that willpower by this some small indulgence that allowed them to not have to sort of double up on their willpower, like, you know, eat these radishes while other people are having cookies, and then go into this tough math experiment. And that was a kind of a doubling up of willpower. So we have to be able to allow ourselves this flexibility to have these small indulgences. And we see that even in athletes as well, and that we talk about that in the book. And this is, you know, very fitting for the theme today as well. So in elite athletics, obviously athletes are extremely disciplined. They are among the most disciplined people on the planet to be able to get through these excruciating workouts. But between those workouts, they allow themselves downtime. And, you know, they maybe have a race, and then they, you know, watch a corny movie. They eat some, you know, indulgent food. They allow their brains and their bodies to be able to have this tactical break before they have to start again. And that allows them to refresh the system, to add that willpower back into the gas tank. So that's a very, very powerful tool, and it's one that a lot of people don't necessarily understand how to use that. And if we are truly hardwired, we have to work with that reward system. We can't work against it.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because with the COVID and the pandemic, everything that's going on, a lot of football games in the pros are getting shifted around. And so it's kind of interesting that we're interviewing this guy and said, you know, you were supposed to have a game and then you didn't have a game. And now it's been 16 days since you having a game. What did you do? And he said, I sat with my wife and watched a movie and had some wine, you know, and like that was something he would never have done during the season. But because he had that break, he just used mm-hmm. that opportunity to basically have an indulgence.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's really, really important. And we see that in top performers all the time. I've talked to people who are executives as well. Maybe some of your listeners relate to this, where they have to be on all the time. They have to be on their game, and then they go and travel, you know, on an aircraft somewhere, maybe overseas. And that break to be able to sit down, put on the headphones, watch a, you know, crazy movie, just to relax. And they say that it almost resets them. It's that refreshing way of resetting your brain. And then you can go back to your A game again afterwards. So these are feeding our reward system. It's the same dopamine pathways that we're feeding, but we're trying to feed them in more positive and conscientious ways.
Alan, sort of related to that is people don't appreciate the importance of volunteering. So volunteering your time releases something within you. And people that volunteer are, it's estimated 40% happier than people that don't volunteer. So, you know, your listeners, if they're not currently volunteering right now, they should try it and see if it makes a difference in their lives. I mean, happiness is 50% genetic. You either have it or you don't. 10% of it comes from having more money. But we know that 40% of it comes from volunteering and strong social support networks. So people should not underestimate the power of volunteering.
Yeah. And that rolls right into the Rosetto effect. This was fascinating. I guess Rosetto was a town in Italy, and especially long-lived folks. And they moved to, I guess it was Pennsylvania, right? Mm-hmm. And they set up another town called Rosetta. And it was all these people, immigrants coming over and staying in that one town. And they didn't have heart disease. And it was fascinating. And they started studying them. And then two generations later, all that's gone. And you're calling that the Rosetta effect. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, Dr. Liu may want to talk about the clinical side of that, but what to start off, it's a very interesting case because, yes, the population, despite their lifestyles, first of all, they were hardworking. They lived and worked in mines. They worked in mines. They didn't have especially great diets. They drank, gallons of wine. So the typical behaviors that you might associate with having, fantastic cardiovascular system weren't necessarily there, but yet they were noticing that they were lacking a lot of coronary artery disease or coronary diseases. So they wanted to look into the effect of that. And the traditional medical analysis of them wasn't necessarily yielding an answer. So they had to look at other areas. And one of the most fascinating and seemed like the determinant factor was the sense of community that they had. So Dr. Liu mentioned volunteering, and it's that social support, that network that seems to be absolutely critical to our health. And we know that intuitively, if you feel that, you know, your family or your friends have your back, you sense that if you were to fall on hard times or whatever, you needed to pick up the phone and call them, that they would be there to help you in a second. That intuitively feels good. It's a stress lowering mechanism in your life. And so that was one of the most fundamental findings of that. And it's a great case for the book as well, because it does illustrate that nexus or that point between our biological medical selves and our social world, and how our social world is so very important.
You know, the tying into Rob's comments, that's why the UK has a minister of loneliness. That's why United Arab Emirates has a minister of happiness, because the literature is now starting to show us that loneliness is worse for your heart health than smoking. Now, I mean, that's pretty powerful when you stop and you say to somebody, loneliness is worse for your health than smoking. And so, you know, volunteering is part of it. Strong social support network is part of it. And this all ties in with the increase in suicide rates that we're seeing as well. That ties in with a lot of social media factors that hopefully we'll talk about. But, you know, you should be saying to yourself, come on, guys, you're trying to tell me that loneliness and volunteering are such basic things. They don't cost anything. You're absolutely right. They don't cost anything, but the impact they have on you is phenomenal.
I think I read in your book, it said that loneliness actually changes the shape of your heart, the left ventricle.
Yeah. We do talk in the book about the changes in our body. There's one that is an effect, almost like the broken heart effect. And that is a clinical presentation, and Dr. Liu may know a bit more about it, but it's a clinical presentation which is like having a heart attack. And that can happen in times of very high acute stress. We see it, they call it the broken heart effect, because you see it oftentimes with the death of a spouse. You're going through that horrible grief that is so very stressful for you. And that can actually play out in the actual way that your heart is working. And you know, the widow and widower effect is very real, where the risk of dying after the death of a longtime spouse is very high within the first year or two, much higher than the general population as well.
Now, I told you I had worked in the oil and gas field, and as you might imagine, when the market's good, everything's great, and when the market's bad, everything's really bad. And so I went through about 3 years of just continuous layoffs until finally my name was on the paper along with everybody else. It turned out to be a blessing because I said I'm definitely not going back to that kind of lifestyle. You brought up something called allostatic load, which is basically, I guess, an accumulation of stress. And I have to believe that was my problem, because I got to a point where everything hurt. Everything just bothered me. It felt like I had no resilience to stress. And I really feel like that's what it was. Yeah. Can you talk about allostatic load and what causes it and what we can do about it?
Yeah. When we talk about allostatic load and allostasis, we're talking about the cumulative stresses that impact us on a day-to-day basis and chronically as well. It's, as you say, it's the idea of that wear and tear that happens on the body over time with all of those stressors. It can be psychological, it can be social, and it can be physical as well, doing night shifts and all this kind of stuff, all adds to this sort of wear and tear. So we want to be able to manage that, of course. And, you know, if we start to venture too far into the stress side of a so-called bell curve, if the middle is the optimum, then we're constantly living with stress. It's a chronic stress condition, and that will obviously bring us down over time. And the same thing if we're under stress as well, that can be a challenge, a different type of challenge. But we want to kind of stay in the middle, and really, we talk about having almost like a flow state. You're staying right in the middle. You're on your game. You're optimum, but your body and your brain are essentially evolved to be able to manage this type of stress. And what we're seeing and we talk about in the book Hardwired is that we are in a super saturated new ecosystem, essentially, that is creating so much stress that we're having a very difficult time staying in that happy place, right in the middle, that optimum. And so now we're walking around with all of this weight of the world stress on our shoulders, and it's having a real, you know, health effect in terms of our actual physical health as well. And Dr. Liu probably sees that that all the time in terms of stress in the clinical environment.
Yeah, let me just add on to that and back up a little bit. So if that stress is present in a pregnant female, that stress actually has an impact on the fetus, so much so that it can change the genetic structure of that fetus. It's called epigenesis. And so that, in combination with adverse childhood events, so that's child abuse, child neglect, child malnutrition will stick with an individual and manifest itself later in life with increased cancer rates, increased diabetes rates, increased asthma rates, increased obesity rates. Just about every chronic disease can be linked back to adverse childhood events. And this stress, especially in pregnant female, is directly transferred to the fetus. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the most important members of our society are obviously pregnant females and kids, you know, in the first 18 months of life. What happens to a child in the first 18 months of life regarding adverse childhood events is going to be with them for the rest of their lives. Some of your listeners may wonder, why am I so behind the eight ball? Well, you know, if you were to go and do a little bit of a forensic analysis of your upbringing, a lot of the reasons why you are who you are today, you know, can go right back to when you were in your mom's uterus.
Now, a lot of people, and I fit this list at one point, I've tried to move away from it. I don't carry my phone with me unless I have to. So right now I'm recording this in a spare bedroom and my phone is in the living room. Now my wife, she couldn't stand that. If her phone was in the living room, she's in the living room. Because she uses the video games and the social media, almost less, she feels like a stress release. For me, it's the exact opposite. I feel stress every time I get on social media. But you brought up the term called nomophobia. Again, first time hearing that word. Can you explain nomophobia and then kind of why, you know, obviously we didn't have social media when we were designed, and it's a new thing, a really new thing. I know some folks out there might not realize it, but we were all born. If you're over 40, social media didn't exist when we were born. Kids are being born into it now, where they're on social media and playing these video games before they really even look like they should be able to hold a phone. Can you talk about this? Because this is actually, I think, becoming, this is going to be big. This might be, in my opinion, going forward, one of the biggest health risks that we have in front of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, nomophobia is a kind of fun word, but it's basically a fear of being without your phone. It's that panic. Where's my phone? And you're patting your pockets and you're looking for your phone. And you know, so it's that fear of being without it. It's not necessarily a fear of losing it. It's a fear of not checking it all the time. So it's funny that the spouse thing, there's about 20% of the population would rather not see their spouse for a week then go without their phone for a week. That's a sad statistic.
It is.
But yeah. And about 90% of the people out there will check their phone and look at their phone before bed. And there's all sorts of, you know, things that happen in your brain with the light that comes off the phone, that, you know, the blue light that affects you with melatonin. But really it has to do with the social side. And it's that ability to not disconnect yourself from what's happening on the phone, the content on the phone as well. So we especially see this in young people as well. So about 90% of them as well sleep with their phone, like right beside them in bed. And about 1 in 5 people will, especially younger people, will wake up in the night to check their social media because it's so arousing for them to do that. So there's a couple of things. One is that as our brains get a very positive reward from looking at our phone. So we get this, as Dr. Liu had mentioned, this dopamine reward center in our brain. It lights up when we look at our phone. Every time you pull your phone out of your pocket and you look at it, you're getting a hit of dopamine. There's other things that have come out with some of the research too. So oxytocin, which is the cuddle hormone, the love hormone that you would have between a mother and a baby, between a couple that have been together in a long, loving relationship, that oxytocin, that feel-good hormone, is also released as well. But we also know that very heavy social media users also have higher rates of depression. So you have this sort of positive thing that's happening, but in the long run, in the big picture, it's quite a negative one as well. And a lot of that, again, has to do with the hardwired part of our brain that is has to do with us being in groups and wanting that social reward. So we're social creatures. We want that social reward to happen. And so all of these likes and everything else that we get on social media stimulate our brain, and we can't get away from it. We can't get away from it. But at the same time, a lot of times social comparison in itself doesn't make us feel great. We compare ourselves to others, and it's sort of that, you know, comparing yourself to the Joneses sort of thing, the neighbors. And when you compare yourself, you can't help but look at the things that are on social media that you might not have, that, you know, you wish you had. And a lot of times it makes us feel a little bit negative about ourselves as well. And Dr. Liu talks about that all the time, about how that, you know, that the ability to appreciate yourself and that self-love is so very important.
You know, it's a matter of then coming and doing a reality check. So you can create whatever persona you want online. It's very simple to do, right? So what you do is you create this image of yourself and your family and your life. But reality is that's not what it's like. And the reason you do that, as Rob said, is you want to belong to part of a group, right? That's how we've survived as a species for so long. And so when you get the like, you get the dopamine hit. When you get, you know, people retweeting you, you get the dopamine hit. But, you know, it also brings out the worst in us. And all you have to do is take a look at Twitter and sometimes what happens with Twitter. And it's like people check their filters at the door. And if it's on your mind and you should have slept on it and you don't, and you tweet it out, you can't pull it back. And so that just perpetuates a cascade of things. And for our young adolescents, belonging is so important. That's why they constantly feel that they need to be present, because if somebody makes a comment and they don't respond, then everyone else seems to gang up on them. And I don't think it's a coincidence that suicide rates amongst our adolescents have shot up by 35% in the last little while. I mean, I see kids in our emergency department on a regular basis that are self-mutilating and attempting suicide that I've never seen before. I teach at the university, and whenever they pull our university students, you know, suicide is on their mind. Mental illness is on their mind. We're raising a generation that's not going to live as long as we did. That's the first time in history that, you know, we're losing traction. And part of it is the opioid crisis. And so you start taking all these things together. And I think the book is a wake up call to everybody, you know, to our politicians, to our policymakers, to our teachers, to our doctors, to our podcasters, to our influencers. We've got to sort of put things on hold for a second and say, hey, wait, you know, it's not as if we don't have enough money and we're not spending enough money, but we're just not doing it so that everyone benefits from it.
Yeah. I at one point in time when I got Facebook, I was like, I'm only going to have people on Facebook that I really know. And I would go through a process about once a year. If, you know, if I had more than 150, and I think that actually is, it was ironic that that's also the number you've said we have connections in our lives, about 150 real connections. And if I got the number, got over 150, and, you know, being a numbers guy, being an auditor and accountant, I love even numbers, like a 50 or, you know, 200 or whatever. So I was at that 150 number, and I'd pare it back down and pare it back down. And then, you know, it'd get a little harder as I went along, and then I'm like, okay, maybe I can let it go up to 200. I might have 350 Facebook friends right now. And I bought an application that takes all the political posts and hides them. It takes all of the fluff stuff and just hides it. And any word I want to put in there. So if I just decided for a day I didn't want to see anything about COVID, I could hide it and I wouldn't even see it. It puts my timeline in order. So it's not Facebook playing that algorithm to dance in my head. It's in the order it was posted. And I can go back to the last post I saw and know that I've seen my whole feed. And there's no reason for me to be on Facebook anymore because I've seen everything that's there. And then I put the phone down. I don't let Facebook send me any other videos or any other things they think I want to see, because they're playing into this whole dopamine, get you on there, keep you on there, and then just keep feeding you the content. It's a formula, and they've got it down really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that happens too is we, especially with the 24/7 news cycle and, you know, obviously the, you know, the political, you know, conflict on both sides of the fence there, we get caught in this sort of fight or flight response all the time. We're always, whenever we pull our phone out, we're looking at the news, it's activating that part of the brain that is really stuck in almost that, you know, very prehistoric evolutionary fight or flight stage. You know, there's all sorts of chemistry in our body that then gets affected by fight or flight. You know, that is the cortisol levels and everything else is, you know, we're bathed in this and that is, you know, very detrimental to our health and our fitness and everything else in our routine. And then in the young people too, if they're stuck in fight or flight, either because of screen time or because they're getting caught up in some of the political drama, and they're confused and afraid about the world as well, then everything starts to become a threat, and they lose that ability to, you know, sit back and use that sort of executive function of the brain and say, hey, you know, and you know, I can filter this and I can make sense of it in a, you know, in a more rational way. They get stuck in that fight or flight as well. And what you end up happening is they start to become hyper-reactive to the world around them. And if you're hyper-reactive, then once again, you get on social media and you see these, you know, the back and forth of the arguments going on social media, and you start to become very reactive to that, and you start to take a side and you start to get involved in that. So it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, this fight or flight. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get out of. And so again, as Dr. Liu said, we're you know, the generation that is now coming up, the young adolescents, the kids, the adolescents, and the emerging adults, the ones that are the college and university age, those are the ones we're seeing the effects of this now that we're talking about in the book.
Yeah, I would say it's even happening for people over 40. I'm seeing it more and more in just the people I interact with. Something will blow up, you know, and you're like, that's not who this person, you know, if I was sitting with them at a restaurant and we were having dinner, that's not something they would say. Mm-hmm. But something here is driving them to an extreme behavior. And it's the stress of the whole thing. They want to be right. I guess they want to be right, but it's just that blow up. And it's really kind of bizarre to see that kind of behavior in someone who, you know, wasn't on social media 15 years ago.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'd suggest for your listeners is that they become familiar with the concept of emotional intelligence, so that they have a really good understanding of their emotional intelligence. And there's plenty of good books out there that you can buy and do this assessment and get a printout of what your emotional intelligence is like. And then the next most important tool that they need to have in practice and get good at is the art of having a crucial conversation. Most people don't know how to have a crucial conversation. And unless you can get a really good check on your emotional intelligence so that you know when you're about to enter a crucial conversation, otherwise you'll end up with road rage. You know, like road rage is a perfect example of emotional intelligence gone wild and inability to have a crucial conversation. Because once you get into that, you know, situation, it's like Rob said, humans will do three things. You'll either freeze and try and camouflage and blend into your surroundings, you'll turn and run, or the hair on your back's going to go up and you're in a full fight mode. And I see this every shift in emergency. Somebody gets their face punched out because they looked at somebody the wrong way or said the wrong thing. And it's pretty frightening. You know, good advice I can give your listeners is you're driving and somebody cuts you off, lay off the horn, ignore them. I mean, you don't know what's going on in that individual's life. You don't know what happened to that woman that day. You don't know what happened, and you don't know what they're on. You know, with this opioid and meth epidemic that's out there, you know, somebody will kill you just for the sake of killing you. So I don't want to frighten people, but just have a really good check on your emotional intelligence. And if you do get into a conversation where you sense it's not going to be a good one, just say, hey, listen, we're about to have a crucial conversation, and, you know, let's follow these certain rules.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Dr. Liu, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Well, you know, it all depends. So most of your listeners probably are at the advantage that they have a roof over their head, they have some sort of income, and they have the ability to want to get better. I would say, you know, the first advantage would be, let's make sure everyone has a roof over their head. Let's make sure everyone gets as educated as they can so that they can, you know, find a good job, keep a good job, find a good mate, and create a nice, you know, strong family. That's healthy for you. You know, the other thing is we have to understand that we're in far more control than what we think we are. And I think the last one, and Rob can refine them, I think the last one is to just understand that we're running on outdated software. And that's why life is so difficult for all of us. And, you know, the sooner we understand that we have to work even harder at it and develop our own strategies and our own sort of patches to make sure this software is operating in the 21st century, and not to be afraid of saying, you know, I'm lonely, things aren't working, I'm not happy, I need help. That's the first sign of getting better, is saying that you want to get help, and stop comparing yourself to others, because you'll always find someone that's worse and you'll always find someone that's better.
Thank you. Dr. Rob, I'll ask you the same question. I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
All right. I'll just build off of what Dr. Liu was saying there. I think that, you know, what we talk about in the book is, and I think the book's purpose really, as Dr. Liu was saying, is a great word, is a wake-up call. Really, it starts with understanding. So it's understanding ourselves and our bodies. And that's always what we want to do in fitness and health, is that, you know, how does my body work? How do I get better at everything? So really, this book is about understanding. It's like a health enlightenment, really. So we talk about the why. So Dr. Liu's always said, you know, why can't I get, you know, why can't I lose weight? Or why can't I stick to this, you know, diet that I'm supposed to be? And, you know, as a doc, he gets those questions all the time. And really, this book is to try to help you understand the whys. And you mentioned it right off the bat that this, you know, there's some really interesting facts and figures in understanding yourself. I think that's the first, thing, is understanding ourselves. And we do that in health and we do that in fitness right off the bat. The next thing, I think, is really understanding what parts of us are hardwired in. What is that software, as Dr. Liu was saying, that we're running on, that we need to respect, that we need to understand, and knowing that, for example, the reward system in our brain, how that reward system works, can we, as we talked about, feed that in more positive ways that then frees up some of that capacity that we have to be able to live a healthier life as well, not get dragged down. And then I think the final thing, and we've touched upon it, is real social connection. That is potentially the biggest thing that can change your life today, almost immediately, is having real human connection. I know it's tough in COVID, but that means, you know, having a kind of connection with immediate family, those who you see every day, spending more time with them, walking in nature with them, having more quality time with them. And not just typing on phones in terms of how you communicate with others, but having real face-to-face conversations with them as much as you can. That social connection bit, and Dr. Liu mentioned it too, the loneliness aspect is probably one of the biggest takeaways from the book. And it not only gives you good health, it gives you happiness as well. So one of the longest studies in the world out of Harvard University, which they started in the 1930s, when they looked at in this case, it was men over the course of their lives, those from fairly privileged backgrounds and those from less privileged backgrounds, they found that at the end of their life course, they essentially said, you know, it wasn't the money that made the big difference. It wasn't the great job that made the big difference in my life in terms of happiness, even though they thought that that was going to make them happy. It was the social connections and the strong social networks that really, really mattered. And those that had the strongest social networks had the greatest health biometrics as well when they tested them.
Alan, one thing listeners should understand is that you're given two ears and one mouth, so you should always be listening twice as much as you're speaking. And that's a very hard thing for most of us to do. But, you know, if you want to connect socially with others, you have to become a really good listener, like a really good listener. And the best way to do that is to repeat what you heard back to the individual so that they understand you're really listening. And the other advice is, St. Francis Assisi said, use words, but only if necessary. So in other words, don't yap too much.
There you go. Thank you for that. Dr. Liu, if someone wanted to learn more about the book Hardwired, you know, anything else that you guys are doing, where would you like for me to send them?
We each have websites. So my website is drrobertbarrett.com. So DR and then Robert Barrett, BARRETT.com. And Dr. Liu's is drlou.ca. So DRLOU.ca.
Excellent. You can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/462, and I'll be sure to have links there. So Dr. Liu, Dr. Rob, thank you so much for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
My pleasure.
Great.
Well, welcome back, Raz.
Hey, Ellen. Wow. That was a lot of information in that interview.
We jumped around. And, you know, the book is really good because it has a lot more than I was ever able to cover in any kind of podcast. But there were those few highlights where I was like, I need to get into this. And as I think I mentioned during the interview, you know, it was just like every chapter, I'm running into something I'd never read before, stats I didn't know. You know, don't go to the hospital. Find ways to avoid being hospitalized. You know, work on yourself because, you know, being hospitalized increases your risk of death significantly, which I was just, again, shocked and appalled a little bit. But, you know, it is what it is. Just, you know, now we know. Advocate for yourself and try not to go to the hospital if you can avoid it. And I don't mean to not do something that you need to get done to prolong your life or to improve your life. But, you know, just realize that you're taking a risk and you have to be proactive as a participant in your healthcare.
Yeah, going under the knife is not an easy decision. But, you know, we've always heard, my mom's a nurse, so we have a lot of health professionals in my family. And that's always the last thing. That's what the doctor tells you. Going under the knife is always the last thing. And so if there's anything we can do to prolong that or change our lifestyle or nutrition or whatever, that might help keep you out of the hospital.
Absolutely. And then I think one of the other cool things that I got into there, and, you know, I do this because I do seasonal ketosis, but they called it, what was it?
Tactical
indulgences. Yeah. You know, it makes sense. And I have a lot of clients that talk about that. And, you know, with seasonal ketosis, I have a period of time when I'm allowed to go do the things I like to do, have some beer, enjoy myself watching, you know, football, that kind of thing. But I do make sure they're good beers, you know. So
make it worthwhile.
It's worthwhile. All right. I'm not just going to sit there and throw down with a, you know, with a national light beer brand. Pick your poison. But I'm going to go have a nice IPA. I'm going to find a local brew when I'm traveling, that kind of thing. But it is a tactical indulgence. It's a period of time. I know when I'm doing it. And I know when I go back that I'm back to who I was and who I am. You know, that's the thing. So, you know, a lot of that is about knowing yourself. And that's why I don't just do it for one meal or one day. I make it a period of time. That's a set period of time because I'm an all or nothing kind of person. I'm not going to have the capacity to sit there and say, I'm going to have two beers and then be done. I'm going to have beers till, you know, we're done, you know, doing what we're doing. So it's a football game. I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to sit there and enjoy myself, not driving afterwards. So boom, you know, have some fun. But, you know, I think that's a really cool concept to think about in as far as your self-awareness is, how do I react to certain things and do I need that reward? You know, I have some clients and they've told me it's like every once in a while they want to do that thing. And I think that's cool, especially when you pair that with the Rosetta effect, which, you know, is us spending time with each other. And it's one of the examples I use quite often is if your significant other invited you to Hawaii, you're going to have a Mai Tai. You're going to, sure. You know, you're going to eat the pineapple, even if you're keto, you're going to enjoy those things and you should, because that's a part of putting joy into your life. And that's a big, big part of longevity. And that's how I, you know, when I say I'm defining wellness, I include that. I probably should have used the word joy instead of happiness. But to me, they're somewhat synonymous. If you have enough happiness, I think it's called joy. But, you know, I think that's the key is, you know, surrounding yourself with people that you care about, having a purpose, and spending time with people. Cause you know, we're social animals. We need that social. I've said this before. I hate that they use the term social distancing because that's not what we need to be doing. We need social adherence. We need to be close to each other socially. Now we might need to physically distance, you know, which is the case. If I'm testing positive, I'm not going to subject someone to COVID just to be close to them. But I am going to physically distance. You know, and so I think that that's just one of those concepts that's really, really important as you're looking at wellness.
For sure. They mentioned the Rosetta effect and the having the social support group, and how that is so critical for somebody's happiness. And that's really hard right now with COVID. And a lot of places throughout the year have had to quarantine. We had to shelter in place in Michigan, or a lot of states did. And it's hard. And even now, getting outside with normal groups is really difficult and limited.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is hard. It is hard. But, you know, and obviously we talked about social media on the show. And social media is not necessarily the answer to being socially connected. You know, I think it can be as simple as picking up the phone. You know, Zoom is an excellent tool. We're using it for this interview or this discussion. Mm-hmm. And so I can see Rachel right now. You know, we're right here. And even though I guess we're probably driving distances, we're recording this about a little over two hours away. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have this kind of conversation, and we could have this conversation even if I were still in Panama. You know, so I think that's what makes this this technology pretty powerful, is you can still visually connect with someone. You can still be engaged with someone, and you don't have to necessarily physically be in the same room with them. So we do have that, but you know, when you can, you know, call your mom, visit your mom, go see your dad, spend some time with them. Have a beer with them if it's a tactical indulgence.
You know, we've done a lot of that this summer, actually, since the weather's been so nice. We've been able to organize activities outside. So we'll sit out on the back patio at my parents' or my in-laws' house and, you know, just spend time. And it's safer outside. You can social distance easily. And the weather's been great for that. Although it's going to be much harder to do the same thing this winter when it's going to be as cold as it gets up here in Michigan. Not quite the same.
I don't even understand why you don't go that far north.
I miss Florida sometimes, let me tell you. And mostly in the winter.
Yeah.
But Zoom is the next best thing. And that's how we're going to have our Thanksgiving. It's how we're going to have Christmas. And our birthdays have been on Zoom this year. And it's the next best thing.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, again, the they've got the vaccine together and they're working on that. And, you know, provided it doesn't turn into the movie Legend, you know, super zombies running around everywhere because they got the inoculation. You know, hopefully all that'll start to work out. And by, you know, particularly by this time next year, COVID will be somewhat of a memory. But still one. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not one to push for an end of 2020. I know a lot of people are like, oh, this is the worst year ever. I think they had it worse in some of the like 1818 and 1812s. And if you kind of look back at history, we were actually in pretty good shape when you break it all down. But, you know, I'm not one to let days go. You know, I'm like, I'm going to make every day count. I'm going to enjoy every day. I'm not going to say let's get to 2021 anytime sooner than we need to get there. You know, enjoy your day and find joy in every little thing. If you don't have a gratitude practice, get one. Think about, sit down for just 5 minutes each day. If you want to journal it, that's awesome too. But find those things that bring you joy and then spend more time doing that. Even if it's a little 5 minute increment, spend more time doing the things and socializing with people and being with people that, you know, bring you that thing. And that's going to be so much more benefit for your longevity than me even telling you what to eat or me telling you, how to exercise. It's really about putting it all together in a balanced lifestyle that, you know, makes sense for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Happiness is such an important part, and whatever it does, whatever it takes to bring you that joy every day, it's important to really search for that, to go after that, not just let it happen. Happiness just doesn't happen. Sometimes you need to go for that. And for me, you know, I like to exercise. I love my run clubs. I've got a really positive relationship with social media, mostly because I follow runners who are always inspiring and motivating. So, but it's important to take some time out of your day to do that one or two things that really helps you find overall happiness and joy.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Rachel, anything else we need to go over before we sign off?
No, this was a great interview. I think I might need to read that book.
Thank you. It is a good book. Like I said, every chapter was something special in that book. I learned a lot from a book, and having done over almost 300 interviews, for me to learn something new, not just once or twice, but, you know, practically every single chapter. This really is something that I think is a well worth the time and effort to read.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Dr. Tom Cowan and Sally Fallon Morell and discuss their new book, The Contagion Myth. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.